Workplace Trust. Apropos which, there are some membership forms if you're not signed up as a member on the bookstall. He runs the excellent Trust website. He's also joint editor of the two superb volumes of Graham Greene Studies, Graham Greene Studies and Graham Greene Studies 2, again on sale at the book sale, produced by North Georgia University. And he's also the co-author of two quite brilliant volumes of bibliography of Graham Greene, and he's working with his co-author, even as I speak, to put a third volume through to the printers. It's written and will be published by Bloomsbury next year. A nice plug there for the book. So your interviewer today is Dr. John Wise.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Mike, and good morning, everybody. My very modest friend here, Mike Hill, did not like to say that he is, in fact, the co-author of the bibliography of Graham Greene, so, but he wouldn't mention that. It's my very great pleasure to introduce to you Ben Brown, who is the playwright, and he's here to talk about a play which I have had the privilege of watching called A Splinter of Ice. So, good morning, Ben. I actually had the pleasure of watching A Splinter of Ice very early on in its run. It came to Malvern Theatre, which is quite near where I live, and it was, apart from the enjoyment of watching the play itself, there was also a great atmosphere in the theatre. It was our first opportunity, and I guess the first opportunity of a lot of people in the audience, to watch live theatre again. And as I just was telling Ben earlier, sitting in the audience, as the curtain went up, you could almost feel the sort of frisson in the air of relief and pleasure among the audience. I've never experienced that before, but that was a truly delightful moment. The play A Splinter of Ice then went on and has been touring over the throughout the UK, and it's in fact going to come to London, which and I hope people will take the opportunity of going to watch it. It's starting a short spell in the end of October, the last 2 weeks of October, starting on the 14th at the German Street Theatre, which, as Ben was saying to me earlier, is a delightful little theatre if you haven't had the opportunity of going there. So do, if you are excited by the sound of this play and you haven't seen it before, then please do take the opportunity of going there. You might possibly have seen it online. It was streamed online, and I say it has been touring the UK. I'd like to kick off, Ben, if I may, by asking you to just give a brief kind of synopsis about what A Splinter of Ice is about, and for those of you who aren't uninitiated in Greene or don't know a great deal about Graham Greene, can you also explain the title?
Yes, okay, yes. So I'll start with the title, actually, then, A Splinter of Ice. I think it's probably one of the most famous things Graham Greene ever said, wasn't it, often quoted, you know, that there's a splinter of ice in the heart of a writer. I think it's from A Sort of Life, I think. I'm looking at Richard Greene now as the kind of expert on everything here. I'm sure there are many experts here, though, Mike and Jonathan. Anyway, which I read as a teenager, A Sort of Life, which is obviously his wonderful sort of volume about his early life. And yes, I think the story came, doesn't it, from, I think he was in hospital, and he, and then something tragic, someone dying near him, and then, but then there was that little part of him as a writer, which was sort of at the same time thinking, oh, this is sort of interesting, and this is material, that sort of, and that's the splinter of ice he was referring to. I think for me, the play is about Graham Greene's relationship with Kim Philby. I think a lot of people know about Kim Philby, one of the Cambridge spies, you know, obviously a famous spy, a Russian spy, and they know, especially here, they know about Graham Greene. But they didn't, most people didn't know about the relationship between them. And I was reading, just to sort of go into how I come to that sort of play through how I sort of got to the idea. I first read about this relationship. I think I was reading Lives in Writing, which is a David Lodge, another famous Catholic novelist, of course, book of his biographical pieces about writers, and I think mostly writers. Yes, I'm sure all writers. Anyway, and in this, he refers, there's a couple of essays, I think, about pieces about Graham Greene. And one of them, though, it talks about his relationship to Philby, which was like, oh, that's interesting. And then, though, he refers to Yvonne Cloetta, Greene's partner for the last 30 years of his life, her book about Greene, her sort of memoir. And so I got hold of that. And in that book, that was the real key for me, because in that book I found this whole chapter about Greene and espionage, and particularly his relationship with Philby, and how important that was to him. Even I think she said that Philby, you know, there was no one he committed himself to as he did Philby. He, you know, more than any other man, Greene committed himself to Philby, she says. So, you know, and this was something that had been very much, this was about 5 or 6 years ago, before Richard's wonderful book. That really intrigued me, what this relationship was, and really what it was, obviously, was that Greene had got to know Philby, because Philby has been his boss at MI6 during the war. First, when I think when Greene was in Africa, in Sierra Leone, and then though when Greene came back in the early 40s, and he was working under Philby, actually not far from here, because MI6 moved out to St. Albans, and also in London, and so they'd sort of formed this great friendship. So when Philby then defected in 1963 to Moscow, I hope I'm not assuming too much knowledge about Philby here and his activities as a sort of when he was, yeah, he's high up in MI6 and spying for the Russians. But anyway, when he defected, Graham Greene was pretty much the only person or only well-known person in the whole country, probably in the whole Western world, to defend him. And he took it, you know, he ended up, he wrote some articles in The Observer, because Le Carré, actually, and partly in reply to Le Carré, having a really good go at Philby. He wrote the preface to Greene's autobiography. And actually, this is the other key thing to the play, because in this preface to Philby's autobiography written in Russia and published in, I think it was 68, I think, then Graham Greene says, at one point he says, about Philby, who he still sort of admired and was defending, essentially, and by analogy with sort of Catholic martyrs of Elizabethan Catholic martyrs, you know, fighting for a cause they believed in. But he at one point he says, one feels the sharp touch of the icicle in the heart, is what he said about Philby. And so it was that, oh, hang on, there's an icicle in the heart about Philby, and then there's a splinter of ice in the heart of a writer. And it was just something about that sort of imagery, you know, obviously an icicle is quite a lot bigger than a splinter, you know. And so that, but again, the heart and the ice kind of, you know, imagery, obviously going back as well to, you know, the old Hans Christian Andersen story and et cetera. But so that was the sort of the kind of key idea for the play. But then particularly when I discovered, and I think I'd already, from Yvonne Cloetta's
work, her memoir, that Green had actually, not only then had he sort of taken this enormous flak for defending him, you know, A.N. Wilson comparing him to kind of visiting Goebbels in Nazi Germany during the war, visiting Philby in Moscow. I mean, you know, it was really, really a massive pylon on Green for this. And then, but then actually going to see Philby as well, because in 1987, as the Cold War thawed, and that there was this meeting that they had in Moscow. I mean, they actually had several meetings, and Yvonne Cloetta went to one, I think, the first time. But, and so it was this curious, I mean, I suppose as a sort of playwright as well, you know, why a play, why not a documentary or a book or whatever it is. And the truth is, there isn't very much known about what happened in that meeting. There are little clues, you know, that of what was said, but it was a sort of space, shall we say, for what I thought was, you know, justified speculation in a play which people know is not, you know, word for word history, and for me to sort of imagine that meeting. So that's what I did.
You got obviously previous, as it were, with these situations where historical events take place, but the actual, and then you build the play around the details behind that. You wrote the play The Promise, which is about the Balfour Declaration to give the Jewish race a homeland. And also 4 days in May. Which was about those in, and that was set in 1940, where there was the key decisions were being made from the Allied point of view about the future of the war. What draws you to that particular sort of scenario where we don't know exactly word for word what is what takes place, but you kind of fill that vacuum, as it were. What draws you to that premise?
Yeah, it's you know, obviously this compulsion to write plays. You know, I think Graham Greene had a compulsion to write stories, and so you're always looking for material. Yeah. And history is obviously a great source of stories and drama. And so these sort of moments, particularly with 3 days in May, for example, there are these moments in history which, you know, things could go either way. It sort of feels this sort of that contingency in which individual humans and characters make a big difference as well, or that kind of fascinate me. So there's a lot at stake, for example, in 3 days in May. This was literally, are we going to fight the Battle of Britain or not? You know, and because it came very close, as people know now, subsequently from the film Darkest Hour. You know, we know that there was a lot of pressure on Churchill, and it could have gone the other way, and all the, you know, not fight the Battle of Britain because we were going to lose. Germans have far more aeroplanes, etc., etc. They just conquered the whole of Western Europe in 10 days or whatever. So you know, it wasn't looking good. So that sort of, but no one knows. I mean, well, actually, in that case, for many years, no one knew what happened in those cabinet meetings, because and in fact, when Churchill wrote the history of it, he completely covered up that there had been any debate. In fact, he said there was no debate ever about, you know, obviously about in his Second World War history, and it was only when the papers were finally released, someone wrote an academic article about 1970, and then more famously, there's a book called 5 Days in London in the 90s. And then did it come out, the story that actually that Churchill was completely lied about this, basically, in his Second World War history, because he didn't want this to sort of look that there'd been any doubt about whether Britain would fight. But in fact, you know, these cabinet minutes were available and would show that it was a 5-man cabinet. And anyway, that this was very much in doubt. Sorry, I'm talking too much about that play, but that was I can't claim there's so much at stake in history as that, or in The Promise, which was very much a British wartime in the First World War, a cabinet decision of literally deciding shall we create a proto-state of Israel? Mm. I mean, that was the question. Anyway, mm. But so, you know, which has obviously had huge consequences. So, but in this play, I can't say there was a huge amount at stake for the world, but I was still fascinated by it from the, because I was so fascinated in these characters of Graham Greene and Kim Philby, who were both such extraordinary and brilliant men, you know, and they and had this incredibly close relationship that people didn't know about. So I do like to try and I do like writing plays about something that people don't already know about. Mm. You know.
Yeah. You did mention just now about the introduction that the famous or infamous introduction that Greene wrote for Philby's autobiography, which was published in 1968, My Silent War. And Greene writes recalling working with him, with Philby in the intelligence services during the war. Quote, if one made an error of judgment, he was sure to minimize it and cover it up without criticism, with a halting, stammered witticism. Does that description strike you as being hero worship, or which I haven't sort of detected anywhere else in Graham Greene, or is it, or was it a kind of detached? What makes that man tick?
I think Graham Greene did admire Kim Philby enormously. And he says, and others say it as well, that who worked under Philby or with Philby in MI6 during the war, that they, you know, they did all, I mean, sort of love him. They, you know, he was so kind of witty and charming, and as you say, that sort of type of thing in which you know, you made a mistake, but he covered up for you. And, you know, people like you if you do that, and you're their boss, and you kind of saved their bacon. Yeah. You know, and but and they had a sort of drinking relationship as well. But no, he did, and Philby had these sort of qualities that Greene, I think, didn't sort of have. Of he a sort of a kind of sort of cool, you know. Greene, restless is a word people often use about Greene, and you know, and it's quite neurotic. I hope that's an okay word to use for myself. But you know, about him, and conflicted and all that. And Philby, even though he had this slight stammer which he'd had since childhood, he sort of had a charm and a cool and a sort of, you know, I've got the world sort of, you know, just you know, I'm looking for the right words. That he had though, this sort of composure that, that Greene didn't have and that he really admired, and that he obviously had to have because, you know, he was one of the greatest liars, 20th century Kim Philby. You know, he was challenged over and over again after Burgess and MacLean defected in 1951, and that threw suspicion on him as a very close. Relationship with Burgess particularly, and so to be able to withstand this intense interrogation. So anyway, so he had this sort of, well, icicle, as we say, rather than and so Greene, I think, admired these qualities, and so he was a, so I think there was, I don't know if hero worship might be going a bit high, but there was definitely, he did look up to him, and I do think I loved him in a way, and this is, you know, this extraordinary comment that Yvonne Clouetta says, that, you know, that because he committed himself to Philby like no one else, and the loyalty, because it did cost him a lot, so that this continued. It's sort of that thing, isn't it, when you're quite young, you know, I mean, I know, well, Greene was actually older than Philby, and he was sort of when he first got to know him, so what, he would have been mid-30s and sort of Philby late 20s, but he still, he was quite boyish, wasn't he, Greene, in a way, you know, he's that enthusiasm, and he was very excited by this world, of course, of spying and, you know, all of that.
I imagine most people in this room will have seen the famous interview that Philby gave when he was asked on, you know, whether he'd ever spied for the Soviet Union. Mm. And I do think, I do agree with you, that even though you're watching a film, you're not actually in the room, something of Philby's charisma does come across in that situation, and you can't avoid it.
I mean, he was wonderfully witty as well, and his sort of sense of humour that they really shared his sense of humour as well, and that's an extraordinary bond of someone you really, you know, just love having a drink with and talking to.
Green kept a diary, which hasn't been published. He kept a diary of the time when he went to Moscow, which Ben has actually talked about. And he went with Yvonne Cloetta, and they spent time with Philby and his wife. Curiously enough, there is absolutely no mention of this meeting, which did take place. He doesn't mention it at all. He mentions the other times when they met up, when Yvonne and his wife were there, but he doesn't mention this meeting where they shared a meal and Green went to his flat. And yet it did take place, because otherwise Green has actually said, yes, we met, but I don't want to talk about it. And just that was it. I don't want to say what took place. And I wonder what your theory is as to what actually drove Green to have this private meeting with him, or was it, as, and this is not meant to be a bit of a spoiler alert here, but towards the end of your play, you suggest that really Green was there on behalf of the secret services, and that he was offering the possibility of Philby returning to London and everything would be forgotten about. What do you feel is the primary motivation behind the meeting?
I think, well, Philby had always said publicly in interviews as well that the one thing, you know, he'd like to do is to share a bottle of wine, sit across the table with a bottle, you know, from Graham Greene with a bottle of wine between them, referring back to how they loved to drink in St. Albans and London and so forth in the war and afterwards as well. So Philby had sort of put that out there very much, that a kind of standing invitation to Green. Green wouldn't go to Russia for many years from the late 60s because of the treatment of some dissidents, Daniel and Sinyavsky, and who's actually, he asked for his royalties to be paid to their families because these dissident writers who had been sent to the Gulag or whatever. So. But then, obviously, in the late 80s, in the mid 80s as well, when Gorbachev came into power, and we had very much the sort of liberalization of the regime, a totally different kind of Soviet leadership, and I think I'm sure they must have been released by then. Actually, Daniel and Sinyavsky, and so Gorbachev, the sort of initial catalyst was Gorbachev, was this invitation to Green to attend this conference which was for kind of peace and a nuclear-free world or something like that. I've forgotten it, and which all sorts of famous Hollywood stars and writers attended. You know, Gregory Peck was one, and all sorts of people, Shirley MacLaine, and anyway. And so Green, that was the sort of initial invitation, and then Green, I think that. At that point, Green thought, well, I'd like to go and see Philby as well. He's in Moscow. I think what drove him partly was, well, obviously Philby had always been saying he wanted to see Green. And this old friendship, which was a very important relationship in his life, even though they didn't see that much of each other. It was this little period in the early 40s, and then, I mean, I think they stopped, they didn't see each other after 51, I think, after Burgess and MacLean left. I think Philby apparently didn't want to compromise Green, that's what he said, but I didn't really, so they didn't really see each other anyway from this time, from the, pretty much the 40s until 1987. Mm. So then, was it 86? Anyway, so then, but Green, I think he was curious in a very big way.
Mm.
You know, he's, he, this man who played such an important part in his life and in his imagination, Kim Philby, you know, suddenly there was this opportunity to re-meet him. As we all feel that, don't you? Suddenly think, you know, that old friend, you know, and it suddenly becomes possible to look them up and to see them, and you haven't seen them since you were at school or whatever it was. You know, and there's that real curiosity, and it's a sort of, it's a sort of narrative curiosity. See what's happened to them now, where they are now, what's happened to them since, you know, what's happened in their lives. It's a very, it's a kind of universal thing. But he had it especially strongly with Philby, of course, because there were all these unanswered questions that I do think that Green wanted. He wanted the full uncensored story, as he says, and he's the narrator of the play and in telling this story. Because I think that's what Graham Greene was. I think he was par excellence a storyteller. Yeah. He was, whether it was his reporting or his fiction or his screenwriting, whatever, that's what he was better than anyone else at. You know, in the 20th century, possibly. You know, he was just a great. And so this story of Philby, and Philby had one of the great stories to tell, which is why there have been so many films and TVs and books about Philby. You know, many, many more than have about Green, because. So he wanted to get from the horse's mouth all the details, absolutely the details as well, of Philby's life since he saw him and the defection and how it was in Russia and how he got away and all of this.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was the kind of thing he was really interested in, as well as this sort of friendship. So I think those were the drivers.
Mm.
But he did think, because, I mean, you know, they both worked for MI6, and Philby said, you know, Green said, you never really leave MI6. It's sort of, you know, the Secret Services. So he was very close as well to Maurice Oldfield, was his name, I think. Mm. Anyway, who was the head of MI6, and he was very close. And he did feel, though, that he needed to let them know that that's what he was planning.
Mm.
And my speculation, but which is not my original idea, but that they said to him, well, could see if he wants to come back.
Yeah.
Which would have been a major propaganda coup. Other people think that's not plausible, but it's anyway, it's certainly that is what the people around Philby said happened as well. Yeah. They didn't say that Green said it, but they said that there were feelers put out to him.
I watched the play, and I was almost sort of thinking what Green was also thinking about what makes a traitor, why did you do it? That was sort of going through my mind, I'm sure was going through Green's mind in his discussions, if that's what actually happened. And you get this marvelous part, and particularly in the first half of the play, Ben, where they're like two tigers sort of circling one another, and there's sort of compliments being passed between the two of them, and then these sort of direct questions, and they're really trying to suss one another out. I read quite an interesting article recently by the writer Ben McIntyre, and it was about what makes a spy, and in fact he quotes Stalin's chief of intelligence services as advising his spy recruiters that likely candidates would be attracted by the feeling of superiority it gave them. And he goes on to actually quote Philby as saying, one does not look twice at an offer of enrollment in an elite force. Does that sort of form of egotism, does that, when you were thinking about what sort of person Kim Philby is, does that egotism sort of ring a bell with you?
Yes, I mean, he did say that, and that's, I think that's in actually a Philby's in My Silent War, and it's in the play in response to, or when he's telling Green as well. Yes, no, I think it does. I mean, there's always a bit like, both, they shared quite a bit in common. Mm. You know, their public school, Oxbridge background and so forth, quite similar. But also, their father, the father question in both of them was quite big. I think, obviously with Green's father being headmaster of this place, and Richard touched upon this idea of those issues of loyalty and betrayal that, you know, when your father is the headmaster, mm. you know, and you know, that are presented as a school child. But for Philby, his father was a tough act to follow, if you like, or a tough presence. Mm. His father was a very, very famous Arabist. He was the first person to sort of go solo across a particular desert, I think it was at the Gobi. But also, and actually, though, became a sort of advisor to Ibn Saud, and very much sort of helped Ibn Saud sort of, you know, cut the British out, actually, and do a deal with the Americans in terms of the oil, which, you know, this is sort of pre-Saudi Arabia days. But so, and he actually converted to Islam as well. Mm. And sort of, he was sort of seen as betraying Britain, and by throwing Britain over in favor of his loyalty to Ibn Saud, mm. and obviously, which then went all the way to converting as well to Islam. So he'd been a sort of big player politically, therefore, as well. And so that you can sort of see this. So for Philby, I think that did influence the way, you know, that he wanted to do something that would impress Dad as well. Something amazing. You know, if your dad does something amazing, you know, like that, you know, I don't know. And he is obviously, and he'd done, you know, he'd followed his dad to Westminster and Trinity Cambridge. And so I think that was, you know, that was some part of it. But of course, there was the more general thing in the early 30s, of the, you know, at least five Cambridge spies, or whatever there were, and all of whom, you know, they were all, several of them were at Trinity, and they were had this Marxist dawn, and, you know, there were these terrible, right, the rise of fascism in Germany, and the hunger marches here. So there were a lot of people, a bit like sort of environmentalism, you know, today, you know, a lot of people kind of feeling quite extreme in how, in, you know, to counter the fascism and to counter, you know, capitalism seemed to be, you know, in a very bad way. Mm. And so that was also, you know, it was quite common. So I think Green understood that. Green was a slightly earlier generation, so he hadn't had quite that, you know, it was the early 30s when it was at the height, wasn't it, this sort of young converting to communism. But then, although Green, ironically, was the actually, unlike Philby, actually joined the Communist Party only for 4 weeks at Oxford. And he says it was just so he could get a free trip there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah.
I read somewhere that you part of your research on Philby, Philby and Green, you went to, or you got obtained the letters which are in Georgetown at University in Washington. What did you learn from reading those letters?
Yeah, I'm just, so this is way back in 2014. I sent off for these, and they very kindly sent back these photocopies. There aren't that many, and there are postcards. Remember this, and you just, you know, you sort of saw there that they're still very friendly terms. They were slightly guarded, though, because they knew their correspondence was being read by their respective, you know, secret agencies. I remember there was a very good one, though. Typical bit of Philby wit, though. Because, you know, he wrote him, because one of the few places Philby could go to, of course, was somewhere like Cuba, being part of being a communist regime. So he sent him a postcard saying, you know, from your fan in Havana. You know, which I'm sure tickled Graham Greene. Mm. You know, I don't think they give a huge amount away, you know, in terms of their sort of content, but just that sense of humour and friendship still there.
Yeah. I mean, what struck me is I've also had a look at those and the ones in which are held at Boston College in Boston and the States, and it struck me as a lot of it was pretty anodyne. There wasn't a huge amount there. There was one interesting one or exchange about the SALT talks, which took place right at the end of their correspondence. Mm-hmm. But other than that, not a huge amount. And I just wondered whether you felt that perhaps the MI6 had redacted some of them. I don't know.
I don't think there was that much. I think they were being a bit cautious because they knew they'd be read. And so, you know, this is why I wanted to write the play, because I felt the meat was in this discussion that they had. He went on a later occasion without Yvonne Cloetta and for a private dinner with Philby and his wife. And I felt that that was the bit you really wanted to be the fly. That was the bit you really wanted to be the fly on the wall and see. Yeah. And so obviously it's the sort of, that's what theatre can do, is you can give you that fantasy. Mm. Now, obviously, it had to be plausible. And we had one or two clues. He later, in an interview later that year, he said to the French journalist Anne-Marie Moutet, I think it is. Anyway, he said, because she asked him about it, and he just said, I think we drank and conversed about the past. But in a way, you might say, well, that's not a lot to go on. Yeah. But, you know, well, they certainly drink a huge amount in the play. But also, the conversing about the past, I felt, because I think that sort of chimed in my feeling that Green really did want all those answers that nobody else had been given, or not frankly, you know, to question Philby about how he had this most extraordinary life of being out and then out of MI6 because he was spying for them and reaching to become head of counter-Russian espionage and then liaising with the CIA. He was sort of our man in Washington. So I mean, he really did get everyone thought he would have been C, the head of MI6 if he hadn't had this suspicion thrown on him. But then he was sort of interrogated but survived that and then got back in, incredibly. He sort of got back into MI6 as well. Mm. And, when he was working in Lebanon, before he was challenged and then he escaped, and did they intend for him to escape or not? And all of this sort of detail, I thought, and Burgess's, his relationship with Burgess as well. So I think, I thought that conversed about the past was, this was, you know, that there was been a lot of questions. Because in a way, they had something in common, Graham Greene and Kim Philby, which is in terms of what they spoke about, they both would rather talk about Kim Philby. Because Kim Philby was quite an egoist in that sense, I think. Yeah. He was rather, and he had all been secret, I think. Whereas Graham Greene, he was more, at this point, I think he was more interested in the story about Philby. So he was, because he had been Philby's apologist, chief apologist in the West, or defender, however you want to put it. And Philby for him had been a great muse, Obviously, the human factor is clearly a quite close idea of somebody, defecting to Moscow.
Yeah.
But even, yeah.
I felt in watching the play that Philby, particularly Philby, was very much on his guard. Throughout the play, he didn't show very, very much emotion, it did remind me so much of that, the famous televised interview which I referred to earlier. But there's just one moment in the play which was incredibly dramatic, where suddenly Philby roars out, with Green saying, well, why did you do it? Why did you betray your country? And so on. And surely all this time has passed. Communism has been sort of shown, the faults in the communist system have been shown and so on. And then suddenly Philby roars out, but it is war. And I thought it was an incredibly dramatic part.
Yeah, I mean, in the play, there's a couple of minutes. He's also very emotional about when he describes how he arrived in Russia, because he was I can't remember where I got all these things from, but they were mostly from things that I read. But, you know, but Philby, you know, you've jumped on a kind of cargo ship in Beirut, and you're kind of arriving with nothing, and you haven't been in touch with these people for a long time, you know. And he was very touched by the KGB guy who went to meet him in this little port on the Black Sea, and because he was saying, I wanted to stay on and serve, and I'm really sorry. He felt like he'd let them down, you know, by sort of, you know, running over there to escape, and he just says, you know, we say it's the beginning of the end in our service if the security service is suspicious of you. They were started being suspicious 12 years ago. It's 51. It's now 63. You know, what on earth do you have to be sorry about? And that really, I do think that really touched him. Mm. That sort of, you know, he almost sort of went naked, if you like, when he defected.
Yes.
I'm sounding very sympathetic to Philby. I think this is what you have to do as a dramatist. You have to be sympathetic to all your characters. Other people, you know, take a very different view. Mm. But anyway, but yes, the point you refer to, because this is what people would say to Graham Greene, and I think Norman Sherry was even on his deathbed, he was pestering him with questions about Philby. You know, I want some last thoughts on Philby and this sort of thing. You know, come on, one more thing about Philby, because he knew that in some ways for the world that was the big story, you know, because people are obsessed with Philby. I think, you know, even more than with Graham Greene, it seems, in terms of books published and films made and so forth. So, but Greene, and so, you know, what everyone said to Greene, all his friends and everyone said to him, how can you be friends with this guy? They said to Graham Greene, you know, how can you stick by this terrible man who has betrayed so many agents, hundreds of people have lost their lives. Because, you know, during the Cold War, there would be plans, you know, to sort of, for counter-revolutions in various countries, you know, Albania and Georgia and so forth, and Ukraine. And Philby, of course, would train the men, and then he was out in Istanbul or somewhere, and then he would take them to the border. And there was a particular case that Green alights on in Albania, these two young guys who nobody could say, which Philby said of many, were ex-fascists. You couldn't say that. They were too young for that, you know. And so, you know, train them and then send them over the border, and then Philby, what they didn't know was that this man they totally trusted, who trained them, sent them over there to try and sort of start this counter-revolution, that Philby had tipped off, you know, Moscow, who told the Georgians, and obviously as soon as they were going to be caught and killed straight, which is what happened. Mm. And so, but people knew this, and this happened in hundreds of deaths because of this. And so people would say to Philip Green, how can you be friends with him? And nobody really understood, I can't think. And so Green, it was very striking that Sherry said, I mean, whatever you think of Sherry's books, which is decreasingly less as the volumes went on, probably in my case, but anyway, you know, he did obviously do an incredible amount of research and spend time with Green. And, you know, he said he'd never seen Green angry or explode like he did when he really pushed him on this. When he said, you know, how can you be friends? How could you support? So it was a really important, sensitive thing for Green, you know, and it was something he struggled with. You know, he was, you know, because he could see that point of view about how can you be friends with someone you hate, you know, this ruthless killer, if you like. But at the same time, you know, he contains multitudes. That's why he's a great writer, you know, and he understood that he could sympathize or understand that Philby was serving a cause he believed in, and that, as you say, and that he saw it as a soldier in a war, and that anything was justified to serve this cause. And Green says that he understood that although he says somewhere, you know, any Catholic or someone of faith can understand that. I don't think that's true. Most people don't, even if they are a Catholic or any other faith, they wouldn't be prepared to be responsible for so many deaths.
Yeah. Playwright aside, and you know, forgetting for the moment that you've written that what are your personal feelings about Philby having done the research quite apart from what you wrote in the play and how you portray Philby in the play, what are your personal feelings about what you know, the man and what he did.
Well, I love what the bit that Richard quoted from A Quiet American, which is a novel I love. You know, about this thing about, you know, opinions, you know, even opinion is a kind of action, which is why I like that. It's one of the reasons, because I often say I don't have opinions. I kind of allergic to them.
Right.
Because I think they're sort of, you know, it's, you know, but, and then he let that further quote, though, you know, you, so sometimes you have to take a side eventually or you don't have any humanity. Mm. So, which I'm slightly worried, actually, because I don't have any humanity. But, no, because the reason I write plays about things is because you're ambivalent, you know. So if I could sort of say in a simple thing what I felt about Fulbe, I wouldn't need to write the play, you know. Mm. And it's, so, in I kind of feel the way Graham Greene did in that way. Mm. At the same time you think it's terrible, at the same time, though, I like Fulbe, which I know that's not the producer of the play, doesn't matter, he hates Jay Sager, you know, but I do think as a kind of writer as well, that you just, it's interesting to sort of hear Richard talking about as a biographer as well, and obviously that's a different job and a different responsibility. But as a sort of, as a dramatist, it really is about, I do think you people say the actor has to be a sort of defense counsel for their character. Mm. But I think therefore as the writer writing those parts, you have to have that to sort of, you know, see things from their point of view.
Mm.
So, of course, but what's interesting, but at the same time, so as Graham Greene sort of understood that, he sort of, and he says this in the play, and I think, you know, I could never have done that.
Mm.
And I could never have done it either. No. So in that sense, of course, you know, however much you believe in something, could you sort of train people, you know, young people, spend all that time with them, befriend them, and then, you know, say, right, now you cross the border here, and then, you know, tip off the authorities so they're murdered on arrival. I mean, you know.
Yeah. The play ends, or it's quite interesting, I might sort of ask you about the end, the absolute ending of the play, but the ending of the play in Malvern has Greene standing in silhouette against a backdrop of the Moscow skyline. And very interestingly, I was looking again at the version which is on the bookstore there. You can actually buy the book of Ben's play, and it ends just slightly differently with Fulbe sitting in a chair, and that's, you know, quite an interesting, which you might want to comment on that difference between the dramatic.
Yes,
side.
I think Fulbe, it's funny actually, this thing, because Fulbe, as you say, the play ends with you know, Greene leaves at the end of the evening. And tells the story of the rest of Fulbe's life, but and very briefly, and then Fulbe, it's left with him sitting and just, you know, reflecting on this major catch up that they've had, you know, and so it still ends like that. But yes, the director and the designer, I'm not sure whose idea it was actually, had the idea of having gradually come up on the back screen, Moscow, because. You know, that was where his loyalty was. Yes. I mean, he also actually, there's a little bit when he's at the very end, they have been drinking a lot of vodka, and then they move on to whiskey that Philby's son had brought, as he did, had brought over. But finally, though, when Greene's gone, Fulbe goes back to the vodka, because it's a sort of an allegiance thing, and you know, it's quite, I don't know if anyone noticed, it's quite subtle, but then the thing on the back, so I think he still sits alone, if you see what I mean. It's just putting the context of where he is and what he believes in, and where he's, you know, nailed his colours to the mast.
Yeah, it was just I felt that, you know, the focus was on Greene, and it's going to lead
on Fulbe.
As a part of the audience, my eyes were attracted to Greene and this figure standing there. You know, in silhouette. And
do you mean Fulbe sitting at the end?
No.
Oh, you mean Greene before he walks off?
Greene, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
That's where my immediate reaction, having, you know, watching this, and it leads me on to my sort of, because I've realised we talked a lot about Philby himself and not very much about Green. I felt at the end of the play, I mean, I asked myself, you know, did I learn anything about Graham Greene? I've always found him a very, very contradictory character and very enigmatic. And I wonder if, I mean, again, and I've also read you're a, you know, an admirer of Graham Greene's writing anyway. Did you feel that you learnt more about Graham Greene from writing the play?
Well, I mean, as I say, what you have to sort of plump various choices. I mean, I suppose, what I was really... the play ultimately is more about Philby than it is about Greene.
Yeah.
As I say, both of them were more interested in talking about Philby than they were about Greene. I think Philby was quite artistical. I don't think he was so fascinated by his own life and his own story, whereas Greene was very fascinated by others and wrote all these wonderful books and non-fiction books about them as well. I obviously in that exploring, he was fascinated by the world of espionage and spying, and he was this incredibly fascinated by Philby and this very important relationship. So, I think you talked about that sort of particularly intense moment when I suppose I wanted to get to that point. Yeah, that is that big question of why Graham Greene stuck with Philby when nobody else did in the Western world. Basically, or except who wasn't perhaps a committed communist. I understood that Graham Greene had written stuff about his Catholicism, or his that and that analogy. So that's I suppose I got more of a kind of handle on that, on that sort of double perspective on Philby. But it tells us about that side of his life and that relationship. But no, if you want to find out about Graham Greene, it's the whole you're far better off reading Richard's book.
Yes, I mean, and I'm always fascinated again in referring back to that foreword that Greene wrote to in to Philby's book, where Greene writes, and he's pinching actually something that Ian Forster wrote. Something to the effect of, who among us has not committed treason to something or someone more important than a country? Mm. Do you buy that?
I think he did. I've called in another article I wrote for the Morning Star, in fact, of course, wanted me to write an article, the communist paper. But I think he was a contrarian, Greene. And there was nothing like, of course that wonderful essay, speech, The Virtue of Disloyalty, which he sort of gave in the late 60s, didn't he, for the Shakespeare Prize. That a writer should change their mind, should defend the people that nobody else is defending, should understand these people. And so once the sort of establishment, if you like, had turned on Philby, I mean, for Greene, that's the kind of, that's the sort of red rag to a bull in terms of his drawing on his own sort of sympathy and empathy and understanding interests. And, he wants to, when the state, I think he talks about, when the state is turned against someone like that. So, he likes, I think, being the sort of lone voice in that way and defending someone who the establishment has turned against. That sort of individual contrarian, difficult kind of part of Greene, was sort of ignited really by Philby. So, yeah, he doesn't. Yeah, once he sort of sees someone being kind of ganged up on in that way, you know, that draws his sympathy, which I find a very attractive characteristic of Graham Greene.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Well,
thank you. Is there any, has anybody any pressing questions that they would like to ask?
Thank you. Yes. No. It's this is a big part of the play. Is the third man? Yes. And Philby was absolutely convinced that Graham Greene had based. No, I can't now remember the source of this, but it's definitely there definitely is one that Philby was at. Yeah, he did say somewhere that when he first saw in 1949, I think it was the third man, you know, a chill went down his spine. Because he thought that was his old friend Greene saying, "I know you're a bad'un," kind of thing. You know what I mean? And it was like, and you know, and he obviously, thought that they were a sort of mutual fan club. He thought Greene was the best novelist around, and you know, and that his sort of acute, sort of psychological insight had understood this, that he was working for the other side. So, and then, as you say, the character being called Harry and his name being Harold Adrian Russell Philby or whatever it was. And then, as well, yes, exactly, because Philby had, in the early 30s, as soon as he left Cambridge, he went and helped the socialists against the fascist regime there at the time, and helped people escape out of the sewers of Vienna. So he thought, I'm not sure. I think I may, you know, that's where Philip Green had got the idea of at the end of the third man escape.
Sorry.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. Well, they were both. I mean, Green once said as well that we were, I think it actually is from one of these, Van Cloete's book maybe, that, you know, they're both men of the left and they're both very anti-fascist. Obviously, Green, Philby was a bit further left, but they had that in common, as you say. He did appreciate that. Of course, you know, Green has quite a good comeback to this theory. Which was that, you know, Philby's theory, which seemed pretty good, that he was the Harry Lyme sort of inspiration, which is that, you know, that his name, of course, being Henry Graham Greene, so his first, which Harry is short for Henry as well, and also, yes, that, of course, Lyme is a kind of green, so it could be me. So anyway, so yeah, this is a key part of the first act of the play, and then it goes on, as you say, when into the second act. Yeah. Anyway, I'm glad you enjoyed that. Yes.
Sorry, I absolutely loved it. What you said, again,
Thank you. I absolutely loved that part of the play, which I saw in Bath. I just wanted to ask a further bit. You left the actors sort of left that situation when the Green character explained, but you went before there were, that Burgess and MacLean weren't known about then. So
yes.
The third man wasn't known about when Green wrote The Third Man. And you left them both looking nonplussed, and the actors played that part brilliantly. Now, it left the question in the air and amongst them, but how was, you know, could Green see into the future? Which is a question that many other people have asked.
Well,
I wonder what you thought
about that. It was so uncanny, because as I say, Philby already had this absolute conviction, and sort of that as soon as in 1949 he saw The Third Man, that Graham Greene had, you know, had based Harry Lyme on him. You know, the name, the plot, the sewers, the character, everything. And then, so then for So then 2 years later, when all the suspicion, when Burgess and MacLean defect and all this suspicion, you know, and this is what massive news, front page news, Britain and America everywhere, you know, that, you know, these two top Foreign Office diplomats had gotten to Russia, suddenly disappeared, and you know. And so then, and then though, there was, you know, who helped them? So suddenly the film, incredibly famous film, Third Man, comes out 49, 51, you know, Philby already sort of secretly fearful and paranoid. 2 years later, all the newspapers in the, you know, in the press everywhere is hunt for the third man. You know, it was absolutely uncanny, and as he says, so no, I don't think Philby, who had less, you know, or fewer spiritual leanings than Green, did really believe, you know, that he'd sort of foreseen the future. But he did. He had to admit it was pretty weird stuff. Yeah.
Okay. I think we've got time for perhaps one more question.
Thank you.
Don't want to keep you from your lunch.
This kind of, just to that, I mean, I think when you think about Graham Greene and chronology in Greenland, you think about what's the commerce between what, how did he know? I find myself doing that all the time. Well, this is clearly related, and then I run it through an actual historical chronology and think, well, that didn't happen yet. So how did he know that? The other thing is, I'm thinking about the third man, and I'm thinking about the scene where the English officer, and I think it's important that he's English, British, says, you know, about the friendship. Yes, but what about all these thousands of people who are going to die from not having this, about this vaccine, which is directly, which I immediately thought of your comment about the people Philby sent to their deaths. Like, where does personal friendship, that's really what this tension is personal friendship, how does that factor when you think about, which goes all the way back to Richard's comment about all these, you know, one man's psychodrama versus all this death.
I think. Yes.
Constant tension.
You know, I mean, I think it's interesting about what she was saying, because fortunately, because I suppose one man, we still care, even though you're quite right and that Green was very focused on, you know, that some of the terrible situations and mass deaths he was covering, he was, what makes him so brilliant as a novelist and say something like The Quiet American is he was saying at the same time, he's also interested in a psychodrama or the psyche or the individual relationships, which manage somehow to express and capture that wider picture. And, you know, you know, in this particular, all those deaths, yeah, I think that was Philby, absolutely that sort of analogy. Why when Green's pushing him on all those deaths he caused, that again fed into that theory of his that Harry Lime was Green's portrait of him that he somehow knew about. And why he's feared that he might be coming to kill him. So, but, you know, yeah, it's, yeah.
I
yes, now, that, yeah, I just wanted to come back to that hero worship point and the sort of love, because, and there is a bit in the play, and Philby, Green tells Philby's wife, he did live. He says we weren't gay, unlike so many Cambridge spies. He sort of clarifies that for Philby's wife, for Philby's Russian wife, who, because, you know, the way Green's talking about her, she wonders if they were lovers. But unlike, you know, Blunt, anyway, but he did love him in a way, he says, and that is, of course, also, he does say that in the play about, because this American producer, was it Sam Goldwyn? Anyway, who rather funnily, when Green and Carol Reed went out to America, to Los Angeles, to discuss the script of The Third Man, just sort of said, I don't get it. You know, he goes over there to find his friend. His friend's not there. Why doesn't he come home? You know, this is buggery, boys, sheer buggery. You know, he thinks, Philby sort of, Green says, well, you know, he tries to explain, but he says to say, well, maybe that producer's right in a way. I mean, it wasn't literally that, you know, male love, you know, fully consummated, but there was a kind of love there. And I do think, yes, I personally think, my hunch is that even though I don't think Green consciously based the character of Harry Lime on Philby, I think that's, I do think that, you know, and that he didn't, I don't think he did know that Philby, what Philby was up to. I think he was surprised in 51, yeah, as the rest of the world was. I do think, though, that his feelings for Philby of his sort of that idea of the friend who you really look up to in the way that Holly looks up to Harry, you know, who you just think is so cool and it really, you know, and what an amazing guy. And you're just, I do think that that feeds in to his, to the characterization of that Green's feeling for Philby that developed in the early part of the war, but feeds into his Holly's feelings for Harry.
Yeah. I think in common with a lot of writers, they draw on different sources. And
or their feelings, exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you.
That was fascinating to listen to and fascinating to hear from the point of view of a playwright. Thank you.
Thank you.
And if I could just add my thanks to Ben, but also, can we have a round of applause for John as well for such a splendid interview? Now, time marches on, so we ought to release you out into a while to get some lunch. I think I'm right in saying that Ben is staying with us for lunch.
If that's possible.
And allows me to advertise where Ben is lunching in case you want to beard him in his lair over his lunch, if that makes any sense. As they often do, the King's Arms on the High Street has very kindly put on a kind of sandwich-type lunch, free of charge. There's a pay bar there, but the grub is free. If you want to join us, any of you or all of you, by all means, make your way up to the King's Arms. Ben will be there. And if you don't know where the King's Arms is, follow the crowd. I'm hoping there will be a crowd. But it's basically up to the main road by going along Castle Street, take a right, walk along until you see, on the other side of the High Street, the King's Arms. You're very welcome to go there. And just to repeat something that John mentioned during the interview there, we do have copies of the play script of A Splinter of Ice on the bookstall, so if you'd like a copy to read it because you haven't seen it, or because you have, as in my case, you'd like it signed by Ben, do buy a copy now. That's your chance to buy it. And if I can just add to one or two of the comments we've had, quite apart from buying the play script, if you get a chance of seeing the play, see the play. It is worth seeing. So thank you very much to both of you again.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you. Thanks. 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 Thanks.